My question this morning, what does it mean? What does it really mean to be a Seventh-day Adventist? Now, this is one of those kinds of questions that you'll have as many different answers as you have people responding, and all of them are good answers. I want to share with you this morning my answer to the question, what does it really mean to be a Seventh-day Adventist? It was camp meeting time. It was my first year in the White Estate. It was Idaho. It was Wednesday, 12:30 in the afternoon. I had just finished eating my lunch at a long table, about 12 people sitting there, members of my big family that I hadn't met before, and I'm happy to be here and meet some more members of my big family that I haven't met before. A man came up and put his hand on my shoulder. I thought he was one of the campers. I discovered he was not. And he said, "Are you Roger Kuhn?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I need to talk to you." He said, "I'm Mark Crane. I am a correspondent for the Boise, Idaho Statesman newspaper. My editor sent me up here to do a feature on this camp meeting. And I've spent all morning, photographer in tow, visiting with campers, interviewing them. I looked at the printed program and I saw that you were down for two seminars, one of them in something called prophetic guidance. And I thought that was very important." And I could tell immediately he was a man of great discrimination. And he said, "I need to talk to you." And I was thinking, because my next seminar was an hour and a half away, and if he needed to talk for a long time, we'd have to set up a time. And I said, how long do you need? And he looked at me and he gave me a funny look and he said, "I don't know." And then I gave him a funny look. And I said, "Well, let's go right now." So I took him down to my room, girls' dormitory. One bed, one chair. I gave him the chair. I sat on the bed. And as we walked into the room, he said, "Mr. Kuhn, every church claims to be the true church, including my own. I'm a Mormon. As a Seventh-day Adventist, what are your claims and what do you have to back them up?" It was a good question. And it deserved an equally good answer. I had never been asked that question before, so directly, so intently. And I said, "Mr. Crane, yes, we do make some claims to uniqueness, to distinction. Not proudly, boastfully, arrogantly. We recognize that to whom much has been given, much more will be required. But yes, we do claim some distinctives." And he was writing down on his pad, and I said, "Lord, help me to get it straight, and then help him to get it straight." By the way, he did. I had to fly that Sabbath morning. I avoid travel on Sabbath if I can, but camp meeting season, I'm going from one camp meeting to another. I had to fly from Idaho to Illinois that Sabbath day. It ruined my day for me. I sat down in a seat in the waiting room there at the Boise airport. Somebody had discarded the Saturday newspaper. I don't read newspapers on Sabbath, but I prayed the Lord would forgive me this time, because that's the day the church page comes out, and I knew the interview would be in there. And so I opened it up, and well, he got Loma Linda closer to Pacific Union College than the map has it. But other than that, he was pretty straight. What does your church claim, and what do you have to back it up? Well, I said, "First, Mr. Crane, we're the only church," and I had just come back from my first trip for the White Estate overseas. I started east, I kept going east, I never quit going east, and I finally wound up back where I started. The world is round, I can prove it. I said, "I have just returned from a trip all the way around the world, India. India's got more religion than you've ever heard." I said, "We are the only people on the face of the earth who make the claim that we find our prophetic roots in Revelation chapter 10, which our sister just read a few moments ago." Now, I said, "Other churches claim to have prophetic roots. You're a Mormon. Your church claims to have." "Oh, yes." But I said, "You don't go to Revelation 10. No, we go somewhere else." I said, "Fine, go where you want to. I'm telling you how we are different from, not better than, we ought to be better than, but we often are not. But we are different from, crucial distinction, we're the only church that goes to Revelation chapter 10 to find their prophetic roots. Secondly, We're the only church that goes to Revelation chapter 12 to find our prophetic messenger. I said, other churches claim to have a prophetic messenger, and he chirped up and said, yes, I'm a Mormon. We have the gift of prophecy in iChurch. I said, fine, but you don't go to Revelation 12. Well, no, we go somewhere else. That's fine. Go where you want to. But we go to Revelation chapter 12. And by the way, tonight and the next four evenings, I'm going to give you the five reasons why I believe Ellen White was a true inspired prophet of God and why you should too. Third, we're the only church on the face of this planet that goes to Revelation chapter 14 to find its prophetic message. Other churches claim to have a prophetic message. He said, oh yes, we have a prophetic message in our church. Yeah, but you don't go to Revelation 14. No, we go somewhere. Fine, go where you want to. But we go to Revelation 14 for our prophetic message, which is worth thinking about these days. And I want to talk about those three unique distinctives this morning because they are so terribly important. In the King James Version, halfway through that little chapter of 11 verses, it says that time should be no longer. In the New King James Version and other contemporary translations, it says there should be no more delay. They aren't disagreeing with each other. They're all talking about the same thing, and they're all right. They're all true. But there should be time no longer. If you travel that dual highway from Albany east to the border of New York State with Vermont, just before you come to Vermont, there's a left turn across this dual carriageway, as my British friends would call it. You have to make that turn, because if you don't, the next thing you know, you're in the state of Vermont. And the Sabbath that I was there, the new treasurer of the New York conference had never made this trip before, and he missed the turning. And so we went into Vermont, turned around, came. I've never been in and out of the state so quickly. And we came back, and then we took the first right. And very shortly after you start down that little lane, you come to an old, dilapidated cemetery. They never heard about endowed care. The rusted picket fence iron gate hangs disconsolately on one hinge. And as you walk in, there is a marker there, almost looks like a miniature Washington Monument. And it's got the name William Miller on it. And it has two of the most important facts of the man's life: his date of birth, February 15, 1782. Did you realize that William Miller was born only 16 years before the beginning in 1798 of the final prophetic epoch, the time of the end? He died December 20, 1849 at 3:05 in the afternoon. The funeral was held a couple days later on Sunday, December 23rd. And then, after the fashion of the day, they put something that would epitomize, as a sort of an epitaph, epitomize the man's life. And what more appropriate could they do than unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed, Daniel 8:14. That was his message. It didn't embarrass William Miller, though he was mocked, derided, ridiculed by the clergy, the editorial writers, the rabble, and generally by society at large in his day. Like Paul, he was not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and also like Paul, he was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. And it was on October 22, 1844, that at 62 years of age, literally worn out, partially blind, covered with boils from head to foot like Job of old, eyesight fading fast, only 62, burned out, he sat on the porch of his house, which today is owned by an Adventist foundation. And you can visit it today. They've been restoring it. Some of you may have even helped in the restoration. And he was sitting on the porch with Joshua V. Himes, his publicity director and public relations manager. And all day long, the people would go by, the Millerites in the community. The little town was called Lowhampton. Today it's called Hampton. I guess they felt Low kind of denigrated it. So these people would go by. Today's the day. Yes, today's the day. And the sun was making its way, as it will today, from eastern heavens to the western heavens, and the shadows were becoming longer, and the faces of those Millerites were becoming longer. And finally, it was dark, And they went into their homes, little groups of them, to sing and to pray. He hadn't come yet. Somebody probably had the bright idea, hey, we didn't call this the midnight cry for nothing. Of course, that comes from the parable in Matthew 25 of the 10 bridesmaids. It was at midnight that the bridegroom showed up, and somebody said, hey, he's even going to fulfill that specific point, that minor point in the prophecy. And so they girded up their loins anew. And the grandfather clocks in New England chimed midnight, and he had not come. How did they get there? Miller, of course, was a native of Loehampton. He had preachers, Baptist preachers, on both sides of his family. Went to war in the War of 1812. Was kind of discouraged with conventional Christianity and had adopted the religious philosophy called deism. Yeah, they believe in a creator God, but he's like a watchmaker, a clockmaker. He creates the clock, the watch, winds it up, sets it going, sets the time, puts it on the mantle, and then goes off to other things. No personal God in deism, and he was disillusioned. But on September 11, 1814, there was a battle of Plattsburgh, the historians call it, in which 4,000 American troops faced 14,000 British troops. Why, the end of that battle was foreordained. And yet, unaccountably, incredibly, the British had more ships and more guns on Lake Champlain than the Americans did. 14,000 to 4,000 on the ground. And yet the British lost and the Americans won. And that just blew William Miller's mind. And shortly after that, he was mustered out of the army, went back home to Loehampton. He said, I'm going to study this Bible once more. And he spent 2 years, from 1816 to 1818. He was interested in prophecy, generally. He was especially interested in time prophecy in particular. He discovered that the idea of a contemporary millennium of great peace, which some of the preachers were talking about and heralding, wasn't taught in Scripture, had no foundation. Laid aside all the commentaries, he took his Cruden's Concordance, took his Bible, he started with Genesis 1:1, and 2 years later came to the last verse of Revelation 22. And he came to an earth-shaking conviction that Christ was about to come in perhaps only 25 years, about 1843. He would later adjust it to 1844 when he realized that there is no year zero. BC 1 is followed by AD 1, so he had to make that little adjustment of a year. It just so surprised him, astonished him, that he went back and he spent the next 4 years from 1818 to 1822 restudying his conclusions. And as a result, when he finished with that, he, with his typically methodical, analytical mind, he formulated a list of 20 points and reaffirmed his earlier conclusions. And he continued studying. But now he started going around visiting the clergymen, trying to see if he couldn't interest them in the fact that the Lord was coming in about 25 years or less. They said, no, you got the right date all right, but it's a great millennium of peace. Well, they were right that he had the right day. They were wrong at the event, just as Miller turned out to be wrong. And it was on Saturday morning, August 13 of 1831. Miller was sitting in his house, and it was almost as if God came very close and said to him, go tell it to the world, go tell it to the world. Our brother Maxwell at Andrews University, Mervyn Maxwell, now sleeping in Jesus, would write a book in 1976, and his title, Go Tell It to the World, about the early Advent movement. And he remonstrated, have you ever tried to argue with God? Yeah, he said, Lord, look, in less than 6 months, I'm 50 years old. I'm, you know, midlife crisis. I'm not ready to start a new career at 50. I'm a farmer. I'm a military officer, justice of the peace, but I'm not a preacher, Lord. Go tell it to the world. Lord, you can't be serious. And he was so agitated that he went outside his house into a little grove of trees behind the house. That grove is there. They stand a lot taller today than they did 150 years ago. And he prayed. And he made a deal with God. He said, okay, I'll go if. One condition. If I'm invited, I'm not going to go out looking for invitations. I'm not going to go out asking people to come hear me speak. But if I get invited, I'll go. And the burden rolled off his mind. And he thought he'd come out with a better part of the bargain. Little did he know, went back inside the house. Half hour later, knock on the door, 16-year-old Irving Guilford, a nephew who lived 16 miles down the road in Dresden, New York, member of the Dresden Baptist Church. He welcomed him in and he said, "What brings you here today, Irving?" He said, "Uncle William, our pastor is not going to be able to preach tomorrow morning, Sunday morning, in our Dresden Baptist Church. And we need a speaker." And somebody said, "Your Uncle William has some interesting ideas about Bible prophecy. Go get him." Less than a half hour after he'd made his deal with the Lord. Well, he was a man of honor, a man of probity. But he was also a very human being. He went back out to that clump of trees, knelt again and prayed. He finally said, "Yes, Lord, I'll go." And Francis Nickel, in his marvelous book, The Midnight Cry, published in 1944, centennial of 1844, nothing more nor less than a lawyer's brief for the sanity of the William Miller movement. And Nickel said he went into the grove, a farmer, and he came out a preacher. Never called himself a preacher. He never called what he presented sermons. He called them lectures. He wouldn't dignify them by calling them sermons. He wasn't a preacher. Well, his first sermon, or lecture, was delivered on Sunday, August 14, 1831. And from August 15, 1831, to October 21, 1844, you have a period of 4,217 days, and if you don't believe me, figure it out. I did. In 4,817 days, William Miller preached approximately 400 lectures, which averaged 5 lectures for every 6 days in a period of 13 years and 2 months. He spoke in some 500 towns from Maine to the Mississippi and even in Canada. Some 200 clergy accepted his views, and some 500 lecturers proclaimed them. And as a result, nearly 50,000, some historians will go higher than that, but we prefer the more conservative figure, from Maine to the Mississippi and a few in Canada, William Miller rocked America, and the tremors of that earthquake were felt even overseas through the publication of the literature, which Himes was in charge of. By Miller's own reckoning, he accounted for 6,000 converts, of whom 200 were previously infidels, 700 were previously infidels. And so it was that he came home. His message, time should be no longer, there should be no more delay. And he was sitting there on the porch with Joshua Himes on October 22, 1844. You know, some Adventists, forgive me, all teachers are nitpickers. I'm a teacher and I'm a nitpicker. Will you indulge me? We sometimes say October 22, 1844 was a day of great disappointment. Nonsense. Nobody was disappointed on October 22, 1844. It was not a day of great disappointment. It was a great day of great expectation. The disappointment would begin the next day, October 23, at 12:01 a.m. when he didn't come. And what was it that the angel said to John? "Take the little book, eat it. In your mouth it will be sweet as honey. When it gets down to your stomach, it's going to be bitter as gall." Mentions that twice in that little 11 verse chapter in Revelation 10, where we find our prophetic roots in not one but 3 different places. Time shall be no longer, no more delay. Secondly, sweet in the mouth, bitter in the stomach. And as the Millerites preached that message, that time should be no longer, that there should be no more delay, it was sweet in the mouth. They said, "Well, you got the right day, but the wrong event." Well, they were right, but they were also wrong. Samuel Snow came up with the date of October 22, which was the Day of Atonement in 1844, based on the Karaite Jewish calendar. And of course, all kinds of untrue myths and legends have sprung up in popular American culture concerning what's supposed to have happened. Ascension robes. Hey, they didn't have any ascension robes. Insanity. Francis Nickel went from one insane asylum to another all through the area checking the records, and you've got the evidence in his book, The Midnight Cry, that insanity alleged to be rampant among the Millerites was a non-event. A 16-year-old girl wrote in her diary these interesting words, eyewitness account. With unspeakable desire, those who had received the message watched for the coming of their Savior. The time when they expected to meet Him was at hand. They approached this hour with a calm solemnity. They rested in sweet communion with God, an earnest of the peace that was soon to be theirs in the bright hereafter. None who experienced this hope and trust can forget those precious hours of waiting. Worldly business was, for the most part, laid aside for a few weeks. Believers carefully examined every thought and emotion of their hearts as if on their deathbeds, and in a few hours to close their eyes on earthly scenes. There was no making of ascension robes, eyewitness. All felt the need of internal evidence that they were prepared to meet the Savior. Their white robes were purity of soul, characters cleansed from sin by the atoning blood of God, Christ. Paul said, unto them that look for Him the second time shall He come without sin unto salvation. And the Millerites really looked for Him. And He added, not to me only, but unto all of them also that love His appearing. And the Millerites really loved His appearing, but He did not come. And the disappointment in His not coming has only been equaled in the whole history of Christianity with the experience of 12 men on a day that today we call Good Friday. There's not a one of them that would have agreed with you on that day that it was Good Friday. Never a disappointment quite like that of those, 11 men and a mother standing at the foot of the cross. And Hiram Edson, a farmer who later became an Adventist minister, wrote in his diary, our fondest hopes and expectations were blasted. And such a spirit of weeping came over us as I never experienced before. It seemed that the loss of all earthly friends could have been no comparison. We wept and wept till the day dawned. I mused in my own heart, saying, my Advent experience has been the richest and brightest of all my Christian experience. If this had proved a failure, what's the rest of my Christian experience worth? Has the Bible proved a failure? Is there no God, no heaven, no golden home city, no paradise? Is this all but a cunningly devised fable? Is there no reality to our fondest hope and expectation of these things? And thus we had something to grieve and to weep over if all our fond hopes were lost. And as I said, we wept till the day dawned. And he was living in Port Gibson, New York, right there along the Erie Canal, that night of October 22, and at midnight, when Jesus had not come, he took another young man with him, believed to be Owen R.L. Crozier, local school teacher, and he and Crozier went out to his near-empty barn. Now, the barns in New York and New England are not empty at the end of October. They are filled, hopefully, to overflowing with the produce of a rich harvest. But the Millerites didn't harvest their crops. People said, you don't really believe He's coming. You're just kind of hedging your bet by filling up your barns. And so they said, we won't harvest our crops. The corn was left in the shock. The potatoes were left undug in the ground. And that barn was nearly empty on the morning of October 23, a gray Wednesday morning. They prayed all night, and then Edson said to young Crozier, let's go and encourage the hearts of the believers. They avoided the road past the barn. They didn't want to run into the neighbors. There had been mocking, plenty of it, before October 22, October 23. But there were some people who said in the back of their heads, hey, you know, I think it's crazy, but if these Millerites are right and he does come on October 22, I don't want to be found laughing at it. So at least it was a bit muted. But on October 23, they came out of the woodwork. And as Edson and Crozier were walking across that cornfield, Walter Martin, the Lutheran minister who wrote the book called The Truth About Seventh-day Adventists, and he tells some of it, kind of thought that was very appropriate because he thought that the idea associated with that field was a corny idea, so it was very appropriate that it was a cornfield, ha, ha. A neighbor spied them, and he couldn't resist. And he cupped his hands and called across the cornfield, Hiram, you didn't go up yesterday, did you? But let me tell you, friend, those Millerites were made of sturdy stuff. He didn't break his stride. He simply called back over his shoulder, no, neighbor, I didn't go up yesterday, but if I had gone up yesterday, where would you have gone? And another critic was silenced, if only for the moment. As they walked along, they didn't feel like talking. And Crozier said something to Edson, no reply, kept going, said something, looked over there. Edson wasn't there, and he turned around and he looked behind. And there, a half a dozen paces behind him, there stood Hiram Edson, almost transfixed, looking up into heaven. Now, I don't know whether what Edson had was a vision like prophets have or an illumination of the Holy Spirit like others have. I don't know, and it doesn't matter. But at that moment, he looked up into heaven like Stephen, 20 centuries, 19 centuries before, who looked up into heaven and said, "Lo, I see Jesus standing at the right hand of the Father." Crozier came running up and he said, "Hiram, what is it?" And in a voice filled with awe, Hiram Edson said, "Crozier, I don't know what it is, but maybe, just maybe, God is beginning to answer our prayers." For what were they praying about? An explanation. What went wrong? Because you see, Edson began to realize, and almost instantly, The time element was right. The event, predicted event, was wrong. What really happened was that our heavenly high priest, Jesus Christ, had moved from the holy place into the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary. Christ still had a work to perform for his people on earth before he could return. Yes, the sacrifice was complete. The atonement was not complete. And that distinction is crucial, my friend, because we hear a lot of noise in certain circles within Adventism who say, "Oh, it was all finished at the cross. The sacrifice was complete." Sure, Paul nails that down in the book of Hebrews. The sacrifice was offered once for all. But friends, the atonement is not yet totally finished, but it will be soon. A sobering thought as we come to camp meeting, is it not? The sacrifice for man was complete, but the atonement was not yet finished. There was a work of cleansing, a work of investigation, a work of judgment to be undertaken. And thus could Francis Nicol declare that the Seventh-day Adventist Church was born on October 23, 1844, and a train of thought was commenced that later would be developed by the study of others. What was it that the angel said, the third thing? We find our roots in three places in Revelation chapter 10. "Thou must prophesy again." And folks, there have been different little schools of thought within Adventism then and perhaps even now as to what exactly that means, "Thou must prophesy again." There were some who said, yes, the sanctuary truth needs to be added to the three angels' messages. Well, I don't know if that's what the angel meant or not, "Thou must prophesy again," but I do know that that's what happened. Then there were, no. That means that the third angel's message had to be added to the first two. Hey, listen, they barely preached the second angel's message. The earliest I can find the second angel's message being preached is 15 months before October 22, 1844. Well, Charles Fitch, Cleveland, Ohio, died just a few days before October 22, preached the second angel's message. The age of 34. There was a third group who said, "No, you're both wrong. That's not prophetic symbolic language. That's literal. Thou must prophesy again." That means that the gift of prophecy is to be restored to God's people. And again, I don't know if that's what the angel meant or not by what he said, but I do know that that's what happened. All three of them are right. And so it was that on an unknown day of December 1844, five women were praying in the upstairs apartment of a woman in South Portland, Maine, Elizabeth Haynes. They were praying about that disappointment 6 weeks earlier, praying that God would give them an understanding. Among those five women praying in Mrs. Haynes' apartment was a girl who was just barely 17. We don't know what the day in December was. That has been lost to history. We'll have to wait till we can ask Ellen if she would remember. But we do know how old she was because her birthday was November 26, 1827, her 17th birthday. But an invalid for 8 or 9 years, injured at the age of 9. You know the story of the rock. Playmate hurled it, angered at some childish trifle. And it looks like God really wanted to confound people. Loughborough was very apt when he said God chose for the third time. She wasn't God's first choice. She was God's third choice, not the first choice. God chose the weakest of the weak. She weighed but 80 pounds. Of course, she was only 5 feet 2 inches tall, but even at that, 80 pounds was not very much. Couldn't sleep in bed, had to sleep sitting up, coughing blood, couldn't speak above a hoarse whisper. There was no more improbable candidate for the office of prophet in the entire history of prophethood than Ellen Harmon, who would later become Mrs. James White. Yes, she wasn't God's first choice. His first choice was a man of color. God is no respecter of persons. William Foy. Delbert Baker wrote that book, published in 1988. Splendid book about William Foy, the first definitive biography. But Foy felt he had too many strikes against him. He was a man of color. And even in New England, for he was living in Boston, even in New England there was color prejudice in those days. There was prejudice against prophets because out there in the West, now Illinois isn't West to you, but Illinois was West in 1844. In Illinois, there was a man out there in a Mormon colony called Nauvoo who styled himself prophet, revelator, and seer. And he was teaching polygamy. And in 1844, did you know 1844 was a presidential election year? Scant days after the great disappointment of October 23, there was disappointment by some people who didn't get elected to office on the first Tuesday in November. And Joseph Smith said, I'm going to run for president of the United States. And they said, which wife's going to be the official hostess? A polygamist in the White House? Even in the West, on the frontier, people were shocked and staggered. And this is one of the reasons why Ellen White never took the title prophet. She never disowned the role, never corrected anybody who called her a prophet, but she never called herself. Two reasons she gave. One is, my work involves much more than most people think when they think of the word prophet. Because most people, even among Adventists today, prophet, fortune teller, predictor of the future. Robert Olson did research, and he said of the 25 million words that Ellen White wrote, not more than 2 to 3% at the most had to deal with the predictive element. Of course, there's some amazing prophecies in that, and we're going to talk about some of them this week during the evening meetings. And so Foy gave up. Hazen Foss, who was a brother to Samuel Foss. Samuel Foss was the husband of Mary Harmon Foss, an older sister of Ellen White. God gave him the messages, and he was angry with God. He felt God had tricked him, didn't show up on the day he was supposed to. Nah. And the angel came back and said, Hazen, get on with it. We got to get some messages out. And he dithered around. Finally, the angel said, you got one more chance, Hazen. He continued to dither around, and the angel showed up and said, forget it. It's been taken from you and given to the weakest of the weak. Then he got scared and he booked a little schoolhouse. Put up posters. Come hear what the angel of the Lord said to me. The place was jammed. Standing room only. The windows were open. People crowded around the windows outside. And he stood up there. You could have heard a pin drop. I was in a certain place on a certain day when the Spirit of God came upon me and an angel came and says, Hazen, I have a message for God's people. And the angel said, and he could not go on. Like Nebuchadnezzar's dream, it was taken from him. He backed up, and I was in a certain place on a certain day, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon me, and the angel came, and he said, I have a message for the people. And the angel said, but he could not go on. And only scant weeks later, Hazen Foss was sitting in his brother Samuel Foss's house, and listening to Ellen Harmon tell her first vision for the first time. And the next morning, he said, Ellen, he said, that was the message given to me. I recognized it. Ellen, you give that message and all the rest of them that follow. And the crown of life that I might have had, you will have. I'm a lost man. And there's no evidence that Hazen Foss again ever evidenced any interest in things spiritual and religious. Ellen Harmon was God's third choice.
And what a ministry. 70 years. She wrote 25 million words. King James Bible has only 773,746. She wrote the equivalent of between 31 and 32 King James Bibles in terms of word count. 2,000 separate prophetic dreams and visions, covered almost every subject that you could imagine. We're going to talk about this in our evening meetings from tonight through next Wednesday night. We find our prophetic roots in Revelation 10, our prophetic messenger in Revelation 12, and our prophetic message in Revelation 14. I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel. I was teaching at Pacific Union College when Herbert Ford, one of my very dear friends who was chairing the communications department there, stopped me on campus. He said, "Have you seen that new Roman Catholic translation by Monsignor Ronald A. Knox, New Testament alone? Have you seen how he handles Revelation 14, 6 to 12? And I said, "No." He said, "Walk, do not run, but get over there to the library and check it out." And I did. And I opened it up, and Monsignor Knox, which in his translation has the Nihil Obstat, the imprimatur of the Church of Rome. It's official. I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having a final gospel footnote. Now, I'm always nervous about footnotes in Bibles. Living Bible, oh, what does he say? "The living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything." Ecclesiastes 9, 5, and 6, footnote. And the paraphraser of Living Bible says, "Solomon didn't really mean this. He was just in a blue funk that day." Well, Solomon really did mean it. In a Roman Catholic Bible, Matthew 16, "Thou art Peter, and on this rock I'm going to build my church." There's more footnote than there is Bible text, because they developed this doctrine of apostolic succession. Peter was the first pope, and on down to the present one. I'm always leery in reading footnotes in Bibles, but I was interested in this one. I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having a final gospel footnote. Why the gospel carried by this angel is said to be final, we are not told in the text. But we note from the context that this is the last message given by God to this world, this side of eternity. Amen. I can preach that. In the 1920s, a meeting was held among Protestant clergy in the United States. I think it was held in New York. Adventists were invited to that meeting, which is surprising because we didn't then have a very good track record of cooperating with other denominations on anything. The fact that they would invite us was amazing. And the fact that one of our men went, Elder W.A. Spicer, who was now president of the General Conference, the fact that he went was even more surprising. The whole purpose of this meeting was to describe a plan to correct a problem which still exists in many parts of the world. I spent 12 years in West Africa. In one village, you might have five missionaries, all of them working to win the same African soul to Christ. You go 20 miles over here, a bigger village, no missionaries at all. This plan was a cost accountant's dream. Let's take all of the Christian missionaries and spread them evenly throughout the whole world. We'll give them enclaves, exclusive enclaves, monopoly. No competition. And the Baptists can work over here. The Methodists can work over here. The Episcopalians can work over here. The Lutherans over... And the Seventh-day Adventists, they can work over here. No competition. And then they polled the representatives of the different churches, and the Baptist representative, "What do you think of that?" "Well, I think that's a great idea. Let's go with it." And the Lutheran, "Oh, that's fine. I'm all for it." And the Methodist, "Yeah, let's get on with it." They waited until all the rest of the churches had committed themselves, and then they addressed Elder Spicer. And they said, "Elder Spicer, could your Adventists go along with this?" And I'm told that when Elder Spicer rose to respond that he had a twinkle in his eye, and I'm also told that when Elder Spicer had a twinkle in his eye, you better look out. And he stood and he said, "Yes," he said, "I think the Adventists go along with this." Everybody just about dropped their teeth. I can only think of one condition that would have to be met. Well, what's that? Well, he said, the only reason that we're going to the whole world is out of default. Default is yours. You aren't preaching the three angels' messages of Revelation 14. That's why we're going. If you were doing that, why? He said, if all of your missionaries would agree to preach the three angels' messages of Revelation 14, we wouldn't need to go to all the world. Now, the speaker of the hour, I have to tell you, wasn't too bright a chap. And he kind of stumbled on and he said, well, Revelation 14 is in the Bible. We all believe in the Bible. I don't know why we couldn't all agree to preach the three angels' messages of Revelation 14. The chairman of the session was sitting directly behind him. He reached forward and he pulled the coattails of the man who was just speaking and he said, sit down, brother, you're making a fool of yourself. Because the chairman of the convention knew what the speaker of the hour did not know, and that is that the other churches couldn't preach the three angels' messages for at least two reasons. Number one, and I do not say this to discredit them, they don't know what they mean, and they admit it frankly in their literature, and I've read it. They don't know what the three angels' messages mean. Now, Royce, where are you? Over here. Royce escaped my homiletics class at PUC. He did wind up in my senior pastoral leadership class, but he was in that transition when Carl Kaufman left PUC to go to Andrews, and Carl Kaufman was the greatest homiletics teacher, with the possible exception of Floyd Burzee in this denomination. We used to have our practice preaching lab, Royce. Two afternoons a week, and students would get up in homiletics, which is the science and art of preparing and preaching, and it is a science and it is an art. I'm still trying to master both of them. And I've seen students get up and take a text that they didn't really know what it meant and try to preach it. It doesn't work. But there's an even more cogent, a more compelling reason why the other churches can't preach the three angels' messages of Revelation 14, because God didn't give it to them. He did give it to us. And dear friends, the only reason for the existence of the Seventh-day Adventist Church is to preach those three angels' messages in different ways to meet different minds and different understandings. What was it the little lady said? In a special sense, Seventh-day Adventists have been set in the world as watchmen and light bearers. To them has been entrusted the last warning for a perishing world. On them is shining wonderful light from the Word of God. They have been given a work to do with the most solemn import, the proclamation of the first, second, and third angels' messages. There is no other work of so great importance. They are to allow nothing else to absorb their attention. And I could keep you here for another hour. I won't. My brethren quit early, and I'm going to quit early. But I've got quotations here I could read you one after another. God gave it to us. What does it mean? What does it really mean to be a Seventh-day Adventist? We're the only people on the face of this globe who find our prophetic roots in Revelation chapter 10, and we find them in three different places in Revelation chapter 10. We're the only people on the face of the globe who find their prophetic messenger in Revelation chapter 12, and as I said, tonight and the next four nights, I'm going to give you five reasons why I believe that that lady was a true, genuine, authentic prophet of the Lord and why you should too. And we're the people on the face of the earth who find their prophetic message in Revelation 14. And for me, that's what it really means to be a Seventh-day Adventist.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.